we have this truth, right? Like this system is built this way and we have to function in it. And we can do things differently in hopes that one day it changes. But for right now, I exist in this system and it's built this way. And what I had said to you the other day was, and it is my, what I tell myself, I'm never going to fit in, so I might as well stand out.
Hello and welcome back to the Business Ramble. We're thrilled to dive into a fascinating conversation today, inspired by a discussion Amber and I had last week with the incredible Nikita Devlin, who's joining us now. Nikita is the co-founder of RIC, a community insurance product provider that's truly shaking up the resiliency and insurance sector. She and her co-founder have reimagined what traditional insurance can look like, creating something both innovative and impactful. In today's episode, we'll explore the unique challenges and nuances of being a female founder, especially as a female founder of color. From navigating industry norms to breaking through barriers, Nikita's insights promise to be both powerful and inspiring.
Nikita, we are so excited to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining us. To kick things off, we would love to just hear a little bit about yourself and RIC and the work that you're doing there. And I really would love to know what inspired you to take such an innovative approach to such a traditional industry.
Yeah, so just a little background on myself. I've had 15 plus years in the insurance sector. I really found a love and a passion there of blending the use of technology and data to think about these insurance models and how they can have impact for communities, especially at the intersection of climate change. So it was actually on my maternity leave when I was staying up late with my son. You know, you spend a lot of hours away, and I had always had the idea of how do we blend technology and use sort of what's now really readily available to sort of to increase insurance in communities, but really aimed at the folks who need it versus my lengthy background and experience in the industry was working for the commercial sector. And I always felt that like we have these really powerful financial tools that were available to the commercial sector, but not available to the individual. And it was late night and I was tired of watching things on Netflix. And I started sketching out what would this actually look like? What could a product that is helpful to an individual versus like a major corporation look like? And how would we do that? I had the knowledge of how to build insurance product, and I had the knowledge of how to build a technology stack to support that. And I am passionate about insurance, even though it sounds like a really boring topic, but it has a lot of potential to do good. And, you know, when you have a kid, you really start thinking about, well, what's the good that I'm doing? And how can I improve that? How can I make him have a better world to inherit? So that's sort of how RIC was born and came about.
I love that. See, people think that motherhood is a barrier to business. And we're like, no. Well, what inspired us to get together and hit record on this conversation is last week or the week before, we were talking through and working with you on prepping for a pitch or presentation that you were giving. And Amber gave some really good sales and psychology insights. I don't know, Amber, Nikita, do y'all remember what exactly it was that was given?
I do. As a female founder, I can tell you what I took home from what you said, which was really important to me in the sense that when, you know, as a female founder, you're already sort of in a room with most likely only men and you don't fit in. And truthfully, like that's just, you know, just by your gender or by the fact that I'm also a brown woman. And so there's all these factors that mean that in the room, I stand out. And one of the things that you said that was really meaningful to me was that, you know, whether they mean to or not, they see it a little bit as a risk because you don't fit in. So starting in a manner to de-risk yourself to them is really important when you're talking about your big ideas and financial models. They want to hear that your thinking behind what you're doing is really sound. And the way I incorporated that into my pitch, like the real world, like transactional value of what you said to me, was that I rearranged how I put together my pitch. And typically, you know, for most companies, you start your pitch with, here's this really big problem that only I can solve. However, I rearranged my pitch and I started with, here's my record of all of the things that I've accomplished over the last 15 years with myself and my co-founder. And I de-risked it for the people who were sitting in the audience that I needed to talk to. So I wasn't doing a pitch for raising VC funds. I was actually doing a pitch for capacity for my product. So I was speaking to reinsurers who run billion-dollar organizations. So I really, you know, the ability to talk about my work experience, it was really important to start the conversation there so that they knew that I was not just coming in as a technology provider, but as an industry veteran who knew what they were talking about and who was leveraging technology to do what we hope to accomplish, right? So that was like, it was so powerful for me to get that information from you. And I have gone through multiple accelerators. I've gone through multiple sales coaching. And they've all been led by men. And the advice that I get just really tends to be a little bit different. They, you know, they really want you to start with like big, bold statements, create a hook, grab the attention, tell them that you're the only person who can fix this problem. I mean, it might work for some women, but it's not the best advice for most women.
Well, absolutely, right? Amber always says this, what has been centered in our life is the white male experience. And I don't want to take your word, Amber, because you said it earlier. You said it to me earlier and it was so good. I don't want to take your words.
Yeah, I mean, our understanding of what's quote unquote normal is the white male experience in Western culture. And we have centered that in a way that anything that deviates from it feels different, wrong, you know, out of the norm, because
dangerous,
because this experience or the one perspective has been essentially said, this is what's normal. This is the baseline. There's a great book called Invisible Women that I highly recommend people read. And it talks about how this plays out in even down to crash tests for cars were only tested on men. When we look at bus routes and communities, they are developed with the understanding that a man's going to get on the bus, go to work, get back on the bus and come home. It's a to and from, not considering the fact that there are caregivers or women that might be going multiple places. And so now they have to take multiple buses and it takes them longer. We see it in medication, how medication is tested. It's typically only tested on the male body because the female body is very complicated and complex with hormonal changes. And when we look at work, again, the tradition or the historical context has been the man does this, their perspective is the one. And it's not that their perspective is wrong, it's just one perspective. And in fact, the reality is it's the minority perspective for the globe. The global majority is not a white man. And half of the world's population is female or presenting. And so when we talk about sales or pitching or any of that, and we continue to look at it from one perspective, and we don't acknowledge the fact that there are diverse perspectives that have other incredible benefits to it and different ways that aren't wrong or bad, they're just different. And our brains read different as danger. And so the neuroscience behind it is it immediately puts us into that fight, flight, fawn, or freeze. And so we have a reaction because our bodies are designed to protect us and our brains are designed to protect us. And so when we initially come into, you know, your traditional sales trainings, it is very like, I'm going to make the cold call and I'm going to do it. And I'm going to call and I'm going to be like, no. You know, and I'll watch these like, you know, sales training guys on Instagram or whatever. And they're like, here's the objection, fight the objection and da, da, da. And I'm like, that makes me want to panic. It's not who I am as a person. I'm a highly relational person. I genuinely, when I get on a sales call, I forget that I'm on a sales call. I'm like, how are you? How was your day? What's new? Just because I'm relationally wired. And instead of fighting that and saying that's wrong, what I want to do is lean into that. And I want to acknowledge, and it's it's frustrating that the reality is, as probably one of the most qualified people in the room to talk about what you talk about, you have to prove that you are the most qualified person in the room.
We've fallen into this complacency out of fear as a culture of what I call like not naming the elephant in the room. It's where the whole I don't see color thing came from, where what happens if you don't call a spade, then we can't actually address anything. There are systemic issues that drive a lot of this. But if we don't acknowledge that there is a different experience for you as a woman and a woman of color, we can't do anything about it. That is actually more dangerous than saying something. It's dangerous to pretend it's not a problem. And it's dangerous for you from just purely from a business standpoint, because if we don't acknowledge that your existence and that you are perceived very differently, we're not helping you. That's detrimental to your business, because you're going to try and fit in a box which was not made for you. And we are setting you up for failure in doing so. So we have to say, hey, the reality is less than 1% of funding goes to female founders of color. That is the reality. Does that mean you need to go have a white male co-founder present for you? Absolutely not. Because we've been told that, we've heard that through other founders, and we've heard other people give that feedback. But what it does mean is we have to get in front of it. I say this in PR all the time. We have to control the narrative and get in front of the story. And Nikita, by the way that you went in there and you started with, let's just get this out of the way, right? You did that. You controlled that story.
Absolutely. And I think that, Sarah, I had said this to you, and it sort of just ties into how we're looking at all of this. We have this truth, right? Like, this system is built this way and we have to function in it. And we can do things differently in hopes that one day it changes. But for right now, I exist in this system and it's built this way. And what I had said to you the other day was, and it is what I tell myself, I'm never going to fit in, so I might as well stand out. Amber, the advice you gave me for the pitch about de-risking myself to folks, it really helped me stand out as well. I was the only one who was doing their pitch starting from that sector. And if you're a VC, you've heard, like, at this point, thousands of pitches. And to be able to stand out by the necessity of having to start in a different place helps me. While I want to get to a world where women can start with a big problem and be a bulldog if they want to, that's not the world I live in. So if I don't fit in, I'm just going to stand out. And I take that to heart in so many ways. As a female founder, one of the things that I realized that I needed to do, and this is just something that is so minimal but has helped me, is that for the most part, when you go to a tech conference or an insurance conference, both of which I go to a lot of them, most people are dressed in dark blue suits or black suits or gray suits. I always, for the most part, try and wear white or a bright color because I will never fit in. I'm never going to be a 6 foot tall white guy. So I might as well be the brightest color in the room so you can come find me if you need to. And it's just something so simple as just like embracing that. Like, do I hope there's a world one day in 20 years from now where tech conferences are filled with women in colorful places? Yeah, absolutely. But that's not the reality that I live in. So I think that we do have this problem, but it's always like part of your mindset as a co-founder or as a founder is problem solving. So here's this very real problem, and how do I make it work for me? So that is one of the ways that I've sort of internalized that information. And one of the other things that I also take to heart when I think about how I present myself or how I present our company, and a way that I see it as a benefit, is that the world or insurance and technology, you sort of just talked about all of the, Amber, you talked about all the systemic ways that women weren't taken into the consideration, both in like medical insurance or, you know, drug testing. One of the ways that, because of that, the world for women and for women of color has been unhospitable to us, right? Like, it's not been the most welcoming world to us. But the upside of that is I'm not weighed down by nostalgia. So
if I'm not weighed down by nostalgia, that means that my brain is the best suited to build towards a future, right? Like, that's something that I feel like if you're, you know, you're talking to folks that you're pitching your company, you're pitching your big idea. And I do think that it's an opportunity as women to highlight that back to these VCs in the sense that, like, I'm not weighed down. That world wasn't built for me. So part of why I'm doing this is because I am building a world that's more hospitable to me. And my thoughts are untethered by some of this nostalgia that might hold back some of your male CEOs. Like, so my vision's going to be bigger and it's going to be broader. It's going to be brighter than some of what, you know, some of the guys might be bringing to the table. And I think there's a real opportunity to embrace that as a female founder. And, you know, you don't have to say it as an attack dog, but you can say, like, hey, nostalgia is not holding me back. Like, I can only go forward. You know, I'm the better shot. And we see that. We see it in the fact that women, female-led companies exit faster. They typically raise less money, but they do more with it. They achieve unicorn status faster. So the data backs up what I'm saying. There is a lot for women to, you know, if we lean into, we're not going to fit in. So we might as well stand out. There's a lot there for us. Keep that close to you and it'll, you know, it'll push you forward.
Love the phrasing on that, right? That it reminds me a lot of the conversations that Amber and I keep getting asked, right? Why is it what we're doing working? Which in of itself is probably not something that would be asked of a man. And it's taken me actually a little bit to realize this because I'm so used to the question. Like, it happened twice in 1 week. It's just a question. But a lot of times our answer is to it, we don't assume anything. We don't have this base nostalgia that you're talking about where we're leaning on and we're assuming. And she and I were not formally educated in business, right? She was in communications. I was in biology, health sciences. It's very different than what we're doing now. But that's part of the reason why we think it works is because you don't have me coming out with my MBA, which is fantastic, by the way. Like, this is not a disparaging comment, but I don't assume that the founder knows that. And Amber is like, well, let's just double check. Let's just dive in. I'm just going to ask you the question. You may have already done it, but let's go ahead and cover our basis. And we start really elementary and rudimentary. And I think that is something that is incidentally skipped over, even in accelerators and these support systems that do such a good job of helping founders really develop aspects of their business. But in doing so, we forget that this was started by duct tape. You didn't become a founder knowing how to run a business. You became a founder because you knew insurance and you knew there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that right there is, you just really loved your phrasing and you're not held back by the nostalgia of it. Because we feel like we're not held back by traditional teaching.
Absolutely. And I would like to give credit where credit's due. I am not the owner of that idea. I read a book a while ago. It was the first biography on George Washington that was written by a woman. Thousands of biographies written about George Washington, but it was the first one that was written by a female historian. And it was her perspective that, like, you know, the past, the history wasn't, you know, wasn't hospitable to women. So she wasn't held back by the nostalgia of the good old days for George Washington. So, and as a historian, your job is to tell the truth, right? Like, as it was. So it was really powerful that, like, I think the book came out a few years ago. I want to say like 7 years ago. You Never Forget Your First. That's the name of the book, which is also hilarious. And she was the first woman to write a biography about George Washington, and she felt that, like, her perspective was going to be different than other male historians. Yeah. And it really resonated with me. That is really powerful. We do have something to offer here. As much as sometimes as a female founder, you feel, I think any founder, you sort of feel like this is a dogfight. Like, how do I keep going forward? How do I progress my idea? But, you know, use that, embrace it. And I will not take credit for coming up with that framework.
That's awesome. And you said something a few minutes ago too, Nikita, that I want to touch back on because I think it's really powerful. We talk all the time about how hard being an entrepreneur is, period. It doesn't matter who you are. I'd say it requires you to come face to face with every part of your who you are, right? Your relationship with finances, your relationship with people in your life. And as moms, all three of us are moms and wanting to build a better world for our kids. And there's just so many pieces of it that require you to do, in my opinion, the good, hard, personal work to be able to show up professionally well. And you talked about how you're never going to fit in, so you might as well stand out. To me, that is an incredibly brave statement because so many of us, I mean, all of us work very hard, whether we realize it or not, to fit in, right? We're hardwired for connection. And we find connection when we feel like we belong. And so can you talk a little bit about how you have developed kind of this skill of bravery that has allowed you to be who you are in the spaces that you occupy and take up that space? You're a tiny woman too, but you take up some space, and I love that.
Sometimes that's also built through being fire tested. And one of the things you do as a startup founder is you have to get really good at telling your story. And early on, one of the things that you need to do is tell your story a lot and get feedback and iterate and do it again. And I had brought this up to Sarah the other day of one of these fire tests that I had gone through. I was pitching in a room of angel investors and institutional VC investors. So, you know, for anyone who might not know, angel investor is someone who's investing out of their, you know, personal portfolio. VC institutional investor, they have a big fund behind them. They work for a big company. And I was in a mixed room pitching, I wasn't the only one in there. There were a bunch of other startups that were in there pitching. And after my pitch, an angel investor came up to me and gave me a piece of feedback. And I'm sharing this because the feedback was, not to discredit him or to make him feel bad, but the feedback was quite interesting. He told me that I shouldn't wear my wedding ring when I am pitching because it's too distracting and because I can't talk about helping socially vulnerable communities wearing such a big diamond. And it's not a huge diamond by any means. And at first I was really sort of taken aback by what he said. I was just like, whoa, what do you mean? Like, I was very much in the mindset of take in all this feedback, iterate. But I do think that like some of that fire testing and forging you have to do within yourself and finding your own confidence is figuring out whose feedback to take. And he said it really genuinely. And I think that like he said it really earnestly. And what I did take away from what he was saying, and if there's any guys out there that are listening, and if there are any women out there that are listening, I think his feedback was important in the sense that like, if I was a guy wearing a $100,000 Rolex talking about helping socially vulnerable communities, yeah, maybe that might not go over well. But his feedback wasn't great for me because I can still talk about socially vulnerable communities and wear my wedding ring, which was a piece of jewelry bought for me, not something that I purchased for myself. And it doesn't diminish what I'm talking about, right? It's part of my story too. And I think it also highlights the fact that like I have the ability to connect with people. I've connected with my husband. We're now married, right? Like, I think as a female founder, like, it's really important early on to figure out whose advice you're going to take and how you're going to incorporate it into yourself. Like, I have read articles where, you know, they tell women to maybe not wear your wedding ring on interviews or whatnot, which is just crazy advice in general.
It's misogynistic advice, too.
But I think that even in getting that bad advice, there's still an opportunity to learn and to sort of take it in, and it helps you build the code of conduct you want to have for yourself. And early on as a founder, and I think this is men or women, you're just given so much feedback that you really have to get really good at parsing that feedback really quickly. And I think specific to female founders is that like, you know, you will be judged on how you're presenting yourself. So you do have to make sure that you figure out how to tune out some of that noise in that moment, there were institutional investors in that room that I could be speaking to, right? As I'm hearing this piece of information that has nothing to do about my company and nothing to do about the people that I want to help, I could have latched onto that and let it be a distraction. But I thanked him and moved on to the people who were most likely going to help me. It wasn't, you know, most likely not going to be him. I think that there is this opportunity to also really listen to the feedback that you're getting from your investors. And if the feedback early on is not aligned with your moralities and not aligned with what you're looking to achieve in the world, right, don't take their money. There will be someone else who's right for you, who's right for investing in your company. So I do think that a lot of those early experiences, don't dismiss it. Figure out how you can use it to build this better version of you and this better version of your company. And don't apologize for it either, right? Everybody starts in this place of not knowing how to do these presentations and how to get the story going. So I think for men and women, don't apologize for it. I think men probably apologize less for it. But yeah, if you're a female founder, like, just sort of just own it, where it's a very humbling experience to sort of put yourself out there on that stage. And just to circle back to what you said about me not being this very tall person, I think that there's all of these things that can throw you off your game a little bit if you're a woman, because this world is physically not built for you. And one of the things I thought was, we saw each other just a week ago and I was presenting and I had the opportunity to stand in front of a podium and I wasn't wearing my heels that day, which I normally do because I'm pretty short. And I barely cleared the podium and it threw me off my game a little bit, because when you feel like you have to tippy toe to get over to reach the microphone, I mean, just own it. Know that there's going to be this emotional energy and this tax that you're going to have to spend on making sure that this physical environment is right for you. And it threw me off my game a little bit when I started pitching, but then I've done it enough that I was able to realize I'm just going to step outside of this podium. And I did. I stepped outside of it so that I wasn't feeling like I had to tippy toe to see the to see the audience. And, you know, you're going to get better at making those small game time decisions of how to make yourself more comfortable in these situations that are always going to be new. Every pitch is going to be different and every room you're in is going to be different. So you know, owning who you are, embracing it, means that you'll be able to make those game time decisions that you need to make. And so really, you're building a fabric of strength and, you know, progress as a founder.
I really resonate with that a lot, Nikita, because in the opposite direction. So I'm 5'7", which is not overly tall, but I've never been a small woman, ever. I was always taller than everyone else. I always weighed more than a lot of my friends. I have larger busts than a lot of them. I can't make them go away, much to some people's chagrin. They're there, right? Had times where Amber and I both have had our clothing policed more than once. With regards to, you know, she also is blessed in the boost department. And, you know, people have said things about that. And I'm 31. I have been for most of my life. It's changing now that I'm post 30, but I spent a lot of my career, which started at 19, as the absolute youngest person in the room. And I remember going to my mom and being like, I'm so young. I'm afraid to tell them my age, because people didn't always know. Right? She's like, you don't need to tell them your age. It's not their business. If you have something valuable to say, your age is not going to change that. But my mom also taught me very young. She goes, no, you do not live your life by other people's standards, but yes, you have to play the game. And whether you like it or not, people are going to judge you by how you look. So go in, pick an armor that makes you feel fantastic and move forward with it. And for me, that was blazers. And they're still my thing, right? No matter what I'm wearing, I throw a blazer with it and I'm like, oh, come at me, please. And it's one of those things that puts you as a female and as a young female, for me, it put me into feeling, yes, I can own my authority in space. And you do need to listen to what I have to say. And I've learned to continue to infuse my own style in there and not just make it just be a regular blazer. It can be I have a very shiny gemstone studded black blazer that I absolutely love, that I wear with jeans and a t-shirt and pointy heels, and I feel fantastic in it. But you're right. You have to lean in and know to make the changes that, one, works best for you, but two, makes you feel good. And I struggled with that truly once hitting 30, and I'm about to turn 32. So last 2 years, really, I've hit this milestone and now I can kind of like let go of it. But so much so owning a business. And I was like, well, I'm 27. Can you bring me in to help you? You've owned your business for 20 years. That's a weird thing to kind of get through. And you have to just be willing to trudge and be willing to keep going. And I had somebody tell me like, well, you shouldn't cuss. Yeah, well, if I can't not cuss for my kid, I sure heck not be able to not cuss for you. I'm so sorry. I will try to be more respectful with my language, you know, if you're offended by it. But it wasn't even a client. It was just some quote unquote well-meaning individual giving me feedback.
Right. That's tone policing too, right? I don't think men get that type of feedback. And I think that for a female founder, you really have to figure out who you're going to let take up mental space in your head, right? Imagine if you were walking into every meeting trying to remind yourself not to curse. That is not what you need to be focusing on heading into that meeting. And I think that for you talking about the blazers and how you have found what your armor is, like for men, they have like 5 suits they can choose from. It doesn't take up any space in their head how to get dressed to be taken seriously, right? Like they have a uniform. And I think that like for women, we have to build our uniform. And it sounds like you've done that. So like check that off your list of like, great, that's not going to take up any space in my head. And it helps you walk into your meeting, any meeting that you're going to be in, more comfortably. I just have to say that like, your business experience, even if you're younger than maybe some of the people you're sitting in front of, like that's not true. You've lived in this more modern world more deeply than they have, and you have something very important to offer them. I think that there's also this opportunity to sort of look at this world that we live in a little differently. Sometimes with men, like as they age, they get to be a little dismissive of age in the sense that they think that someone is younger and dumber. I view it differently in the sense that as a woman, as I age, the way I look at the world has changed a little bit, but I will never be dismissive of someone younger because they grew up and lived in a different world than I do. And I do think that there's this opportunity as female founders and hopefully the next generation of corporate executives to sort of fold that thinking into how we look at who we hire and making sure we incorporate a younger generation's viewpoint into how we're building our path forward. So I hate that you were so dismissive of yourself. And I want to say that that's a strength. It's a strength that you were able to bring to these companies who, you know, what they're doing might be a little stale and you're bringing in this new perspective. And I think as founders of any company, we should always be looking to say, what is the next generation talking about? And how can we involve them that's in an appropriate way in the conversation? Because we're building this company, and at a certain point, you are going to have to hand it off to them, right? It's not your vision for forever. So making sure that you have a pathway to incorporate younger voices in what you're doing, I think is really important. And I think it's something that I personally feel like women are really good at doing that. Like we're always willing to hear all the voices in the room. And we don't need to overtake all the voices in the room too, right? So when we talk about future building, this is why I think that female-led companies also have this benefit of us being able to incorporate more easily that youthful voice into what we're doing, because we don't have to look at it as a threat. We already know that that's going to be a benefit to us because we have no nostalgia, right, about that past, right? We can only build a better future. So we're already primed to sort of know that's of benefit to us to listen to what that youthful person is saying and figuring out how that can apply to the work that we're doing.
I mean, absolutely. I am a marketing professional, and I already told Amber, we are not hiring anyone over 24 to do our marketing. because there is a lived knowledge in the channels, and I can do strategy all day, but as far as the nuance, those details which are make or break, I can't. And that's okay. I don't want to. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not my lane. Amber always says, like, that's not my business.
Well, and I can confirm, because I'm 44. So Sarah and I are in two different generations too. And good gracious, it is such a gift to have a business partner that has a perspective that can see things in ways that I can't. Like, I didn't have a cell phone until I graduated from college. It wasn't a thing. And when my first cell phone was a flip phone, and you had to pay for like every text. But Sarah came up with far more technology. So even when we think about our social media strategy and everything, I'm like, again, it's none of my business. Like, whatever you tell me to do, I'll show up. But I don't have the same perspective and framework to understand. I'm learning. I have teenagers, so I know a whole different language. But I think it's really important too to recognize, again, as women, the patriarchal system is hierarchy. Matriarchy is a circle. It is communal. It is collaborative. And when we talk about company culture, one of the key things we talk about is not only are there diverse perspectives at the table, but are they genuinely heard and acknowledged and taken seriously? Because you can check a box and say, we have a woman, or we have a person of color, or we have a female. You can check a box, but at that table, if the opinion is stated and never taken seriously, and that diverse perspective or that differing perspective is not taken seriously, the culture of your company is not going to thrive. It's just not. And even if it's all men sitting around the table, which can be problematic, there's still diverse perspectives there. If one person is always saying, this is the way, that can get really, really challenging.
I think it's important to also just acknowledge that as we age, we come with our own biases. And like, to circle back to why I think some of these youthful perspectives are going to be really interesting to business, I think about things like crypto. I think about things like blockchain, and I think about things like AI. And we're living through this world right now where all of these new technologies, they come in really hot. There's usually a scandal, right? And there's this really big cycle. But I think about the next generation of leaders that are growing up right now who, from the get-go, they've heard about AI, they've heard about blockchain, and they've heard about crypto. And their memory of some of these scandals, if you look at with FTX and crypto and all of that, mm-hmm. Those scandals might not resonate as deeply with them because they were a little bit younger when it was happening. But my bias is, oh my gosh, crypto is so unsafe. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not. What I'm saying is, let's hire that 24-year-old who doesn't come with that bias against these new technologies and hear what they have to say about how they think it's going to impact the future. And that's, you know, as someone who works in the insurance financial technology sector, for right now, for our company to be talking about crypto or to be talking about blockchain, that's probably not something that we can do, because the folks that I'm selling to are going to be equally as a little hesitant about that. But in 20 years from now, the market's going to change. The kids that are growing up right now, they might want to hear that we're backed by some USDC crypto, a crypto fund, right? Because they're like, yeah, that's more democratic in the way that we're organizing our financial outlook of our company, right? Like those.
Yeah. So
absolutely. I think that there's that flexibility that I think is built into women because we need to be flexible to survive. As a founder, I never want to lose that. And I think that just tying back to what you were saying about making sure you have diverse perspectives in the room, I do think we end up thinking about it really deeply. And that's why we are able to bring such diverse perspectives to the table.
Well, and I think we would be remiss if we didn't take some time today to hear a little bit more about that perspective and what Rick is doing in the insurance world and in parametric insurance, flood resilience, all of those things. Tell us more about your product and how I view you're changing the world.
Absolutely. So what we've done is we've built a technology platform from which we hope to launch parametric insurance products. And for those of for those folks who are listening who don't know, they've never heard the word parametric before. Essentially, the way that these insurance products work is, did event A happen? Yes or no? If yes, here is a predetermined amount of money. And you can liken it to Aflac. Did you go to the emergency room? If yes, here's this, you know, $500 to help you towards that bill. And where Rick is looking to work is in the climate change space. We know that, you know, because of climate change, we're seeing more frequency of these events. We're starting with rainfall flooding, but there's also, you know, when you look at climate change across the map, it's wildfire, it's flooding, it's hurricanes. There are all of these events that are happening more frequently in communities. And we know that by increasing the financial liquidity of a community post-catastrophe, we can bend that cost curve down and make the folks living in that community more resilient. So I said some like jargony words there, but essentially what that boils down to is if we can get cash into these communities faster, people can recover more efficiently and faster. And what that breaks down into is you'll pay less taxes at the end of the year, because if there's more insurance in your community, the less of it becomes a problem for the municipality to have to, you know, raise funding to pay for repairs through tax dollars. So with us and how we're looking at things differently is a lot of these parametric products used to be really available only to larger purchasers of insurers of insurance. So think big commercial companies. And we're leveraging technology to be able to offer these products to a renter or to an individual household or to small commercial businesses. So it's really about taking these financial products that have worked well for a long time for major corporations and infusing it into a community at the household level and making it affordable and available to these individuals. So we're starting with rainfall flood, but our products will all be under $50 a month with an estimated max payout of $10,000. So really trying to keep it in line with what people can afford monthly and how much money that they'll likely need post-catastrophe to help them get through the first couple of months. And what's unique about what we're doing is that these products are not just tied to property damage. You know, when you think of wildfire flood, you think about oftentimes it's just your property that's covered through insurance. But with parametric products, we're able to say this $10,000 that you're going to receive can be used not just to replace anything that's physically damaged, but it can cover financial losses too. So if you have to miss work, if you have to hire a babysitter, if you have to, you know, put gas in your car from three towns over and it's quadruple the price it normally is, those are all financial losses that you're incurring, and you can use this payout to cover all of that. And you get the money in your bank account because we know that you're the best person to figure out how to spend that money the most effectively and efficiently. And that's really putting, flipping the insurance paradigm on its head, because typically when you have a loss, you have to go through a multiple month long journey with your insurance person and prove to them that you've had all of these losses. What we're really looking to do is let's flip the script on that. Let's give you the money. We know that you've likely had maybe potentially a larger loss than the $10,000 that we're giving you because this is a big event, a big extreme weather event that happened in your community. But we also know that you're more efficient and making that $10,000 stretch and work for your household than us if we came in. You know, we're really coming in with this mindset that we trust our customer and they know what's best for them. And I think that that's something that I want to see more of in the insurance industry. And to do that, we need more parametric insurance products being offered at mass into renters, homeowners, and small businesses. So that's really the perspective from which we come to. How can we support a community with these financial tools? And how can we make sure that these financial tools are flexible for the real world? Right? Not the world that insurance companies think we live in, where we keep every single receipt of everything we've purchased.
When we first met and we were learning about parametric insurance, which I had never heard of, and we were talking about, you has said a phrase that has stuck with me the whole time. You said it restores the might of the community. that is huge. You know, you are putting agency back into the community and allowing people to be able to make the best decisions for their families and for themselves, which is huge, especially after a major disaster, to be able to say, look, and we saw it with Helene, like people couldn't evacuate because they couldn't afford it. You know, and so this would allow people to be able to evacuate or, again, cover kind of those initial costs that they probably don't have access to that capital. And you're restoring the might of the community was one of the most powerful things I've heard you say. And as you talk about it, because that's exactly what you're doing.
Thank you.
Real quick, Nikita, tell me how this is different in the way of how we even take on a policy like this. So what we have seen with our current insurance culture is that I, as an individual, recognize or am mandated that I need to have insurance for this, whether it's my car, my house, whatever else. I have to now go and I shop around and I have to see what I qualify for and can afford to get on a monthly basis to cover what property I have. How is that different from how someone would get involved or sign up for a parametric insurance policy?
Sure. So this is where my nerdiness comes in. I get so detailed with that question of how parametric insurance works. But I'm going to start with, where can someone go purchase this? And for right now, the insurance industry is really heavily regulated. So you can't just go to parametricinsurance.com and purchase a parametric insurance product. Where we're working is actually at the intersection of, we need to distribute our product through the existing insurance value chain. And where we've found alignment is actually with the local businesses in a community. So think the major sectors of healthcare, the municipality, and manufacturing. Those tend to be the biggest job providers in any local community. And where we're coming in is actually offering our products as an employee benefit to the employees working in those sectors. And there's an alignment there with the employer, who knows that the faster the company can get their workforce back to work, they know that they can improve their bottom line if they can get their workforce back to work faster. And that's where we're starting. We're also having conversations at the community level with municipalities who are looking to figure out how they can leverage these products to make their community more resilient, right? Because in order to increase the resiliency in the community, it has to be really widespread and widely adopted. And where the municipal level, where the municipality comes in, is that if what they're looking at is purchasing these products on behalf of the community so that it's there and available for all of the folks living in their community, regardless of where they work, regardless if they're a renter or a homeowner or a small business owner. So I think we've done a really good job of building this table that's welcoming to all the stakeholders in the community and taking into account all of their needs to make sure that these products have a really widespread distribution and adoption, and taking into account everybody's critical pain points, which is, we need more money flowing into communities post-disaster, and insurance is one of the most efficient ways to do it.
Last question. So what do we tell our individual listeners that they can do in order to encourage perhaps their municipality or their employer to purchase a policy that they can benefit from?
Well, first, let's start really easy. Go follow us on Instagram or Facebook, and you'll probably have to read it a couple of times, but what is parametric insurance, right? Like, follow the content, just learn about it organically, so that when you are speaking to your HR person, or let's say you're a business continuity manager, or you're an HR person, or you're the CFO of a company, everyone is trying to figure out how they can be the best steward of their company through a climate experience, because they know this is an eventuality. Your company's going to have to live through a climate catastrophe of some sort. So I think that, like, very early on, that one of the best things you can do is just make sure you're as educated as possible on these financial tools, and follow us on Instagram or follow us on Facebook, where we're putting that
that information so that when the time arises, you can speak about these products and say like, well, have we tried this? What would it look like if we tried this? And stay curious, right? Climate change is all hands on deck. And I think the best way to combat it is to stay curious and keep asking, well, what's new? What are new things we haven't tried? And what's realistic for the next year or two that we can get out the door to help make our community or make our workforce more resilient?
Yeah. And I would even add to that, if you are a decision maker in a position of leadership in communities, do some research, pay attention, hit Nikita up on LinkedIn and ask for a conversation. Because we are seeing already the opportunities and the benefits to communities in the western part of Virginia that are interested in taking this pilot program on and embedding it into their community. And again, restoring the might of the community. This is one of those, it feels like a no-brainer, right? It is an incredibly affordable resiliency solution that does provide a significant benefit to the citizens of your community. And I think one of the other things that you've said to us that has really resonated is the communities that do take on or take initiative to bring in some of these resiliency things, it benefits their communities in ways that didn't even occur to me. Their credit score goes up as a community. Mm-hmm. They're able to then leverage insurance and this insurance product in a way that provides potentially other funding or opportunities because they're able to show that they've put in place resiliency solutions and ways to mitigate some of the catastrophe and the rebuilding. So if you are a decision maker in a municipality or a first responder or any of that, speak up and have a conversation because it can really benefit your community. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. This conversation, I always love chatting with you, and this was absolutely no exception. Thanks again for being on, and listeners, just remember, insurance is sexy.